Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Rania Masri of the Institute for Southern Studies, who discusses the status of women under Saddam Hussein's regime, during U.N. sanctions, and now under U.S. occupation. BBC investigative reporter and author Greg Palast, who explains why he believes reform legislation enacted after the scandal-ridden 2000 election could result in disenfranchising up to 1 million minority voters in this year's presidential ballot. And veteran human rights attorney Leonard Weinglass, who remembers the celebrated peace and social justice activist David Dellinger, who died on May 25th at the age of 88. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Professor John Mearsheimer, conservative political scientist at the University of Chicago and a self-proclaimed realist on foreign policy, backed George Bush in 2000. But now the professor is supporting John Kerry because of his opposition to the Iraq War. According to the American Prospect magazine, there is a growing split on the political right over the Iraq War. A diverse coalition of conservative intellectuals have banded together to oppose the neocon agenda of Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and Paul Wolfowitz as nothing more than empire building. Analysts from the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation, Pat Buchanan's magazine The American Conservative, and other scholars have formed the Coalition for a Realistic Foreign Policy. Several liberals, such as Chalmers Johnson and Gary Hart, have also joined the coalition. The realist school believes Saddam Hussein did not pose an imminent threat that justified war. But the divide among conservatives on Iraq is not reflected in right-wing media organs such as the Wall Street Journal opinion page or Fox News. These outlets continue to pump out pro-Bush, pro-war points of view. Paul Jagot, the journal's editorial page editor, dismissed the objections of libertarians at the Cato Institute and other conservatives as four or five people in a phone booth. As Professor Mearsheimer replied, the Wall Street Journal is like Pravda. They don't tolerate dissent. In the late 1990s, Michael Vallant, a 29-year-old schizophrenic inmate from Utah, was stripped naked and strapped to a restraining chair by prison staff for not taking a pillowcase off his head. However, soon after he was released from the chair, Vallant collapsed and died from a blood clot. The incident made national news after the inmate's family successfully sued the state of Utah and forced the state to stop using the restraining device. As a result, the state corrections commissioner, Lane McCotter, resigned. By May 2003, McCotter was working as a prison consultant in the infamous Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq as part of a team sent by the U.S. Justice Department. According to The Nation magazine, McCotter was hired just 3 months after the Justice Department's own Civil Rights Division had released a scathing 36-page report on inhumane conditions in a New Mexico prison run by a private company where McCotter was a top executive. In a statement released in early May, McCotter insisted he had nothing to do with the prison abuse and torture scandal at Abu Ghraib. Instead, his job was to oversee structural renovations at Iraqi prisons and train Iraqis as corrections officers. Judy Green, a prison reform consultant, charged, "McCotter is no expert on how prisoners should be treated or how prison staff should be trained." The Financial Times reports that the Bush administration is looking to exempt a well-known arms trader, Victor Bout, from United Nations sanctions because of Bout's role in aiding U.S. military operations in Iraq. The U.N. is currently debating which individuals should have their assets frozen for their close affiliation with ousted Liberian strongman Charles Taylor, who faces war crimes charges in Sierra Leone. The UN is moving on Taylor under pressure from France. In the recent past, Bout was described as a merchant of death who owns air transport companies that ferry arms to rebel and government soldiers in several wars in West Africa. A Western diplomat close to the negotiations lamented, "We are disgusted that Bout will not be on the list, even though he was the principal arms dealer in the region." In March, the UN Security Council passed a resolution freezing the assets of Charles Taylor, his immediate family, and close allies and associates. The aim was to stop Taylor and his cronies from using misappropriated funds and property to interfere with the restoration of peace and stability in Liberia and neighboring states. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Zelfia Hunter.
One month before the symbolic transfer of sovereignty in Iraq, Chief U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer, along with U.N. Envoy Lakhdar Brahimi and the Iraqi Governing Council, named a new prime minister and president of an interim government who will lead until elections next year. The appointment of Iyad Alawi as Iraq's next prime minister has many observers questioning his acceptability among the Iraqi people, as the exile leader was formerly associated with Saddam Hussein's spy agency and now linked to the CIA. The process of filling the mostly ceremonial post of president revealed serious conflicts between members of the governing council and Washington. But as combat continues between U.S. occupation forces and resistance fighters in Iraq, the plight of Iraqi women is largely ignored. They are rarely, if ever, seen in Western video footage of the war, but the U.S.-run Coalition Provisional Authority cites as one of their biggest accomplishments the liberation of Iraqi women from the rape rooms in use under Saddam Hussein's regime. The Bush administration also touts what they claim will be greater opportunities for women in future political participation under a new Iraqi constitution. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Rania Masri, director of the Southern Peace Research and Education Center at the Institute for Southern Studies in Durham, North Carolina. Since the UN-US sanctions were put in place in 1990, before the first Persian Gulf War, Masri has been active in supporting the people of Iraq during their humanitarian and political crises. She is part of a team that produced a just-released feature film called About Baghdad. She discusses the status of women under Saddam Hussein during the sanctions and in the current period under U.S. occupation.
The status of women in Iraq has actually deteriorated, which is in sharp contrast to what we're told by the Bush administration. What we had in terms of the status of women during the Saddam Hussein reign is, yes, there were no political and civil rights afforded, neither to women nor to men. But nevertheless, women did have the best legislative rights in the Arab world. They had them in Iraq. So in terms of rights of marriage, rights of divorce, inheritance, and other laws that mean a great deal to women's life, the most liberal were those in Iraq in comparison to the Arab world. And at the same time, there was a very large percentage of women who held professional positions, such as doctors and engineers and lawyers and positions of that caliber. And then came the sanctions, 13 years of sanctions imposed upon Iraq from 1990 until 2003. And during that time, we saw an amazing increase of unemployment. And what we know is whenever there is unemployment, the very first community to suffer is always the women. They're the first to get fired. And so during that time, we saw women's rights, women's positions in employment drastically decline. We also saw somewhat of a rise of Islamic fundamentalism, which we've seen happen whenever you enforce poverty upon a community, you have a rise in both the right and the left. And so when we had the rise of this way in Iraq, we also had some very backward laws reimposed upon Iraq, laws that were not imposed pre-sanctions and that were then reimposed during the sanctions, such as the, so to speak, honor crimes. What honor crimes are is they allow the husband, the father, the brother, the uncle, the cousin of the woman to commit murder, to basically kill a woman in the event of suspicion of her honor. So if one of these men thinks that the woman in question has had out-of-wedlock sex, or has done other, so to speak, honor crimes, then the man can kill her and receive a lesser punishment for that murder. And it was abolished before, and then it was reimposed during the sanctions as an act by Saddam Hussein of making peace with the right-wing Islamic representatives. And then here we had the occupation period, and in the occupation, none of women's rights that had been abolished during the sanctions were restored. Moreover, none of their economic rights were restored because now we have a situation in Iraq where the economy is worse than it was during sanctions, if we can possibly imagine that. On top of all that, the security position for women has deteriorated dramatically. Never before in Iraq's history did women have such a difficult time getting physical security. So we have an increase of rape, we have an increase of kidnapping, we have an increase of mass violations of physical security imposed on the women by the military occupation itself. So, for example, just a few days ago, we had the killing of 41 men and women at a wedding. The kidnappings is taking place by militia forces that are just rising up in the country whenever you have a breakdown in security. And it is a security that they have completely failed in providing since the 1 year that they've been occupying Iraq. So the status of women in Iraq now is worse than it was before.
But there have also been restrictions placed on women by fundamentalist Iraqis, no?
I'm not really sure how that has taken impact upon women right now. What we hear from as the main complaint of women in Iraq right now is the complaint of the threat to their physical security. That because of the threat to their physical security, they don't have the same kind of freedom of movement that they had just a year ago. Incidentally, there has been a rise of feminist organizations in Iraq recently. And these feminist organizations are demanding not only for them to have civil rights and political rights under whatever Iraqi government comes to take shape, but they're also demanding that the rape of women be monitored. And the U.S. occupation authorities are refusing to even monitor the rape of women in Iraq. And I'm talking here about the rape outside the detention facilities. So we know that the treatment of women within the U.S.-imposed detention facilities in Iraq is horrendous. And if we take into consideration that 70 to 90% of the men and women in the detention facilities are, according to the U.S. military, held by mistake, then we see that the rape of these women takes an even greater crime than it would be if these women were even suspects. But they're completely innocent and yet deprived of their rights. So now they're seeking to always have some kind of a chaperone, some kind of a protection with them. And this is especially worrisome for families with daughters who are going to school, and also with sons, because the security situation for the sons isn't that much better than it is for the daughters, because there's been this dramatic increase of kidnappings. So in that sense, it's just one more thing for families to worry about. Just as they're worrying about the overall security of their family and their overall safety of their family, they also have to worry about who's going to take the daughter to the school and who's going to wait for her at the school and who's going to be able to bring her back. That kind of an escort service that was not present in Iraq previously, where women were safer. You know, women did feel much, much safer in Iraq, even during the sanctions period, than they feel right now in Iraq. We're being told right now that women's rights are increasing in Iraq because they've been guaranteed a 25% representation in the government that will come to be. As a feminist, it really makes no difference to me if we even have, you know, all this appointed government be women, if they are appointed, because then they cannot claim to serve the interest of Iraqis. And what we need to be fighting for is for the government that will come to be in Iraq, for it to be a democratic government, one that the Iraqi people themselves have actually voted for in a free and open election.
That was Rania Masri of the Institute for Southern Studies. For information on the new film About Baghdad, visit the website www.aboutbaghdad.com. Contact the Southern Peace Research and Education Center by calling area code 919-419-8311 or visit their website at www.southernstudies.org. Until the 2000 presidential election, most Americans saw their nation as a model of democratic ideals, where one person, one vote was valued above all else. But with memories still fresh about the Florida election scandal, where tens of thousands of votes were eliminated by defective paper ballots and allegations of deliberate disenfranchisement, U.S. voters are looking warily at the coming 2004 presidential election. In reaction to the voting scandal, Congress allocated billions of dollars to upgrade the nation's voting equipment. But growing questions about electronic voting machines' reliability and vulnerability to manipulation have slowed progress on modernizing the U.S. electoral system. As November approaches, state, county, and municipal governments are scrambling to improve the mechanics of voting, hoping to avoid a repeat of the 2000 election, which saw the Supreme Court install George W. Bush as president, although he had lost the popular vote by 500,000 ballots. In the midst of the tumultuous 2000 election recount in Florida, BBC investigative journalist Greg Palast uncovered documents which established that Florida officials had purged more than 57,000 registered voters, a majority of them African Americans, Hispanics, and likely Democrats, off the rolls in advance of the November vote.
Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Greg Palast, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, who explains why he believes reform legislation enacted after the scandal-ridden 2000 election could result in disenfranchising up to 1 million minority voters in this year's presidential ballot.
2004, our president signed a law called the Help Americans Vote Act. And as soon as, you know, George Bush tells he's going to help us vote, I got a little bit of a problem, right? So now, what is it that's in this baby? First of all, the Florida purges are going to be taken nationwide. Second, they got $4 billion mostly to help computerize our vote. And let me tell you, we've already tested this thing out. See, Catherine Harris, when she was leaving office to go to congressional heaven, she ordered a test and an imposition of electronic voting machines, of computer voting machines, touch screen. And it was tried out in Broward County. And in the white precincts, it seemed to work pretty well. I mean, that is, we can't tell. I mean, but nothing that anyone could see went wrong. In the black precincts, poll workers couldn't find passwords. The machines crashed, power failures. When the machines crashed in the white areas, the tech teams came in like, you know, SWAT action. In the black areas, they said, we'll get to you tomorrow. As a result, thousands and thousands of black votes were lost. They either were never punched in or they just disappeared in, you know, in an electric storm. In other words, the computers worked perfectly. That's the game. And in fact, I've been working on this issue with Chris Edley, the dean of the University of California Law School at Berkeley, and statisticians with the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. And here's what we found. In the 2000 election, 1.9 million votes in America were cast and never counted. They called them spoiled, right? Couldn't read them. What they found out is that nationwide, over half of those votes that are spoiled are cast by black folk. 1 million black ballots just go poof in a typical general election. 1 million black ballots. And the Democrats are pretty silent about it, especially because the biggest spoilage, the biggest dump of black votes occurs in Florida, occurs in Georgia, where the Democratic Party does not like the black intrusion into the party, and occurs in Chicago, where the baby Daley machine survives as a white minority controlling a black majority Democratic Party. So basically, both parties are in on this kind of lynching by laptop that's going on.
Given all this information about the purging of voters, the disqualification of quote-unquote spoiled ballots, what, if anything, can we do to avoid the kind of cross-continental fraud that we saw back 4 years ago?
We just have to restore an interracial movement that says that when one person loses their rights, we're all going down. And now we know that. When they don't count the black ballot, by definition, you just got canceled out. Most of the listeners of your program just had their vote canceled out, see? Second, tell the truth on them. In other words, go to my website, www.gregpalast.com. There's a petition that Martin Luther King III and I have. Click on the MLK petition. Sign up electronically. We have 75,000 people have signed up already. And we're giving it to Ashcroft, by the way. And people ask, why do you give it to Ashcroft? The answer is, we know he's watching us, but we want to tell him we're watching him. So it's harder for them to do it. It's harder for people to do embarrassing things with the lights on.
Tell us a little bit about the Diebold Company and electronic voting and the hazards for our democracy therein. You were one of the first reporters to discuss this right. issue. It's sort of come into its own. It's more widely discussed than it was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, well, you know, a terrific colleague of mine, Bev Harris, is, you know, showed that how easy it is to hack into Diebold computers because she did it, and how you could change a Democratic vote to Republican vote if that's what your mindset is, and that will happen. But I think the bigger problem is the dumb stuff that's so hard to trace. Someone pulls a plug, the machine goes zap. In black areas, they don't provide the tech support. They don't train the poll workers. People in black communities are less familiar with touch screens, and so they want to make it so that this is the subtle way you disenfranchise. So late opening polls, they frustrate people. The polling takes longer than possible. And then you have, you know, the multilingual issues will now become monstrous. Imagine testing a software program and the hardware with millions and millions of people on a single day, and the outcome of the U.S. presidency relies on that. I mean, you wouldn't do that with a program to give you suggestions for a summer vacation. But they're not doing it because it's stupid. People keep saying, well, if they fix this Framis and they put on this gimmick, and if you have a verification trail and all, They don't want it to be fixed. It's working, like I said, the Broward County test succeeded. White communities voted, black communities disaster. We're going to see it all over America. Get ready for it. You heard it here on Between the Lines.
That was Greg Pallast, an investigative reporter with BBC Television and the London Observer newspaper. Read his columns online at www.gregpallast.com. His book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, was recently updated and re-released by Penguin.
It's a rather important conception, both what's apt to happen in Chicago and also what kind of a movement we're trying to build. We're trying to set up a setup in which the energies of the anti-war movement can be unleashed or liberated. We are united on the demands of withdrawal of the U.S. military from Vietnam and support for black liberation.
On May 25th, David Dellinger, a legendary pacifist organizer who struggled for peace and social justice for more than 60 years, died at the age of 88 in his home state of Vermont. Dellinger, who attended Yale and Oxford, devoted his life to a variety of causes through exercising nonviolent direct action. He refused to serve in World War II, for which he went to prison, and later published several prominent progressive magazines and spent time in Spain during that nation's pivotal civil war. Dellinger went on to serve as a principal organizer in movements opposing the nuclear arms race and the Vietnam War. As a defendant in the famous Chicago 8 trial, which followed militant protests that disrupted the 1968 Democratic Convention, Dave Dellinger left his mark as a courageous activist, not afraid to speak truth to power. He, along with four co-defendants, were convicted of crossing state lines to incite a riot, later overturned by a federal appeals court, as were several contempt citations. Later in life, Dave Dellinger and his wife Elizabeth moved to Vermont and remained active on many issues, including prison reform. At the age of 85, Dave participated in raucous protests in Quebec City aimed at derailing the Free Trade Area of the Americas Treaty. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with veteran human rights attorney Leonard Weinglass, who served as counsel, along with William Kunstler, to the defendants in the Chicago 8 trial. Weinglass, who has represented Angela Davis and Mumia Abu-Jamal, among many others, remembers David Dellinger.
Well, Dave was a very warm and caring man, and he was always very proper in manner and very suitably dressed. But under all that was a very strong individual who had a great deal of integrity and lived his life according to principle.
You represented these men in the case now famously known as the Chicago 8 trial. And Leonard Weinglass, maybe you could just briefly tell us about what were the main features of that trial and Dave's role there. Because as I've heard you say, the case was formally known as the United States of America versus David Dellinger.
That's right. And it was aptly named. So this was obviously a political trial. And Dave's name was the first name in the indictment. From top to bottom, from Dave Dellinger, a nonviolent organizer, to the leader of the Black Liberation Movement, this indictment really encompassed in one document the anti-war movement and the movement against racism as it existed at the time.
Dave Dellinger, as I understand it, in the courtroom, was very vocal in terms of his denouncing the proceedings, denouncing Judge Hoffman, denouncing the prosecutors. Maybe you could explain what was going on in that courtroom in that historic trial.
Dave was really at the center of it. The prosecution, they had a problem with Dave. He looked like a typical middle-class American. He came in with a suit jacket and a tie. The rest were all wearing sweatshirts and T-shirts and tie-dye shirts, and Dave looked in a way that it would be hard to convince a jury that he was part of the planning of a riot. And so they labeled him the architect, implying that he stood behind the scenes and manipulated the younger ones, he was the oldest by 20 years, into doing these riots that he really wanted. I mean, it was totally ludicrous. And even in Chicago, even with that jury, they rejected the idea that Dave was part of a conspiracy. So they were acquitted on that charge. But Dave refused to rise on the first day when the judge entered the courtroom. And the discourse between Dave and the judge at that point is fairly typical of Dave. He made it very clear to the judge that he doesn't respect false authority, that in order to be in receipt of respect, authority had to earn the respect. And Dave informed the judge that he hadn't earned that respect in terms of the way he conducted the trial. And so Dave was sentenced to contempt for not rising. And we took an appeal after the case was over, and there were a number of contempts, a record number of contempts. And the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, upon being apprised of the full record of what happened, did something that really shocked people. It reversed all of the contempts, writing that it was principally the judge who was provoking what was happening in the courtroom.
In 1996, almost 30 years after the 1968 Chicago Democratic Convention, another Democratic Convention convened in Chicago, and Dave Dellinger went to demonstrations there. Tell us about Dave and his comeback to Chicago.
Yes, we were all invited back to Chicago, where we were received by the mayor, Mayor Daley's son, and we were wined and dined, and we were on Larry King Live, and everyone was saying that the world had changed and the Chicago 8 had changed, and now everybody is friendly, and let's put it all behind us, and there's nothing more to demonstrate about. And Dave participated in that. But true to Dave Dellinger, when he heard that there were demonstrations, in fact, although they received very little media attention, Dave left the hall where all of the ceremony was taking place and joined the people in the street.
What's the lesson that we can all learn from Dave Dellinger's life, you know, as you look at your association with him in these trials in Chicago, and you're following his work over the course of 60 years? What lessons can future generations learn from him, do you think?
The lesson that Dave leaves us is that you must stay attuned to what's happening in your time. You can't just be engaged in one situation and feel, no matter how it's resolved, that you've done your best, and that's that. As long as there is someone who is suffering an injustice or under the heel of oppression, Dave tells us, and his life tells us, that you have to be by their side. It's the only way to live. It's the only satisfactory and fulfilling way to live, is to be part of a struggle for justice.
That was veteran human rights attorney Leonard Weinglass. To offer condolences, write to Elizabeth, care of Toward Freedom, P.O. Box 468, Burlington, Vermont, 05402. Dave Dellinger's autobiography is titled From Yale to Jail. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website, www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Zofia Hunter, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.